Man on Board, episode 29. Today, the category is Shakespeare. We're going to be talking about the games Shakespeare and Histrio. In our broader view, we're going to have a discussion about settings in games. Hello, and thank you for downloading Men on Board. My name is Aaron.
This is Josh.
Jameson.
And I'm Matt.
And for, I think, the second time in the last couple of months, I am not feeling well. And I don't want everyone to think that I'm one of those people that's constantly sick. But for some reason, I have just been under the weather on two recording nights in recent past. Today's category is Shakespeare. Well, in a sense, it's like Shakespearean style of plays. Because I don't know if Histrio necessarily explicitly says it's Shakespeare, but like, it's Shakespeare.
There wasn't a rabbit in a Renaissance costume on the stage. That didn't really happen. Shakespeare's also totally real, guys.
Just kidding.
What?
Nothing.
What's your Shakespeare conspiracy theory?
There's a big debate over whether Shakespeare's actually a person or not.
Yeah.
Or a rabbit. Yeah. Or a collection of rabbits.
I just didn't realize that you were like into that theory.
No, I'm not really into that theory.
So, the first game we're talking about today is Histrio. Histrio was published in 2016 by Bombykes. It was designed by Bruno Cathala and Christian Martinez, with art by Jeremy Fleury. Histrio is a game where players are competing to gather the best troupe of actors and acrobats in order to put on performances that are most pleasing to the king. The board in this game consists of a series of cities numbered 1 through 8, and as the game progresses, different cards are going to be placed below those cities. Simultaneously, players are going to decide which city they're going to go to. Players will reveal their choices, and if only one player is going to that city, they will collect the cards there. These cards could be bonuses that will just give them coins, which are endgame points, acrobats that give abilities that can be used once per season, and actors that have different abilities that they'll let the players do, but they'll also do different things at the end of the season whenever players are putting on their performance. There's a really cool component in this game that's a three-dimensional stage, and this stage has a track on the top that shows whether the king's favor is more in the mood for tragedy or more in the mood for comedy. Different actions in the game are going to be able to push that king's favor meter one direction or the other. One particular way that gets moved is if two players simultaneously reveal the same location. If that happens, neither player is going to get any of the cards that they wanted. They're going to get discarded, and any actors that were discarded are going to control which way that the king's favor gets moved. Fortunately, though, players will get to draw a secret request card that will give them an opportunity to potentially score points during the show. At the end of the season, players will score points based on the number of actors they have that match the favor of the king, as well as who puts on a better show that is more in line with the king's favor. They'll then have an opportunity to score their secret request. Players will then get to play a second season, where they'll do the same thing all over again, and at the end, they'll score in a similar way. And whoever scores the most coins from winning the king's favor or collecting them throughout the game is declared the winner. So Jameson and I played this game for the first time last week, and we had a very frustrating experience with it.
Well, we did, but having played it once and sort of seeing how, well, taking a step back, one thing that happened was that Aaron and I went to the same city for the whole first season, essentially. And over again. The two of us went to the same city, got no rewards, and all we did was get the challenges.
Technically, me and Jameson went to the same city for the first four. And then me and Shelly went to the same city for number 5.
That's right. I got a bonus for number 5.
And then me and Jameson went to the same one for number 6. So I collected no cards for the entire first season.
That being said, so at the time it felt like it was incredibly frustrating, but the game was still moving pretty quickly. There was still a lot of color. And I ended up winning the game. So looking at it again, sort of having played the game through once, knowing the tempo, knowing the tone, even though there's so much chaos, it can kind of be managed and it can certainly be clawed back from. I think that the game is intentionally, like, while there is, I really like a lot of the mechanics in this game, I think that the art is fantastic as well, and I think that it doesn't overstay its welcome, and there are things that would be incredibly frustrating in a 3-hour game here that just kind of feel like part of the ride for me because of its length.
Yeah, and I think you just hit the nail on the head, because I was going to say the same exact thing. If this game took a longer amount of time, I would be infuriated by that play. But I've played it several times since then and had much different experiences that were enjoyable. It was just the odds of that, the odds of us just continuously, while it does increase each time because we have the same pool of available cards, still felt incredibly unfair.
I think the odds of it happening on our first game actually are pretty low, too, because I feel like as we I think there's more of like a sort of Sicilian style of second guessing. The more you play a particular game with a person, like the more you are trying to anticipate their patterns. This, it really was dumb luck. And so because it happened that way, I think it really shaped our perspective in a way that wasn't necessarily accurate. It can still happen going to the same city four times in a row and then another time right after that. But the odds of it happening were pretty low. And I think that, it didn't happen because of decisions that we were making so much as just dumb luck a lot of the time.
Having not played the game in a while, I have two questions about the city visiting. One, does the number of cities on the table change based on player count, or is there always the eight cities?
Always the eight cities, yeah. Unless we played it wrong.
Is this a game where once you've chosen a city, does the card go back into your hand, or do you have to wait for a mechanism to have it shuffled back?
No, it goes into a discard pile, and you're either going to pick up your cards whenever you only have one card remaining, or whenever I believe the actors of level one will let you pick up all of the cards. Because like I said, each of the actors has a different ability. And the nice thing about this game is as you're selecting cities to go to, you're sending out little ships out on the board. So you don't have to like constantly be looking at other people's discards to be like, where can they go? Where can they not go? It's very visually easy to see what the options are.
It's also persistent from season to season, which is a really important detail that I missed when I was on my first playthrough. But it gives it a level of consistency that I think is really good. At the same time, it does contribute to what Aaron and I were experiencing, where the more that you're locked out together, the more likely it is that it's going to happen again and again. So there actually is this weird little natural statistical increase of frustration as it starts happening, which I'm guessing was not intentional.
I will not say I don't go into this game expecting the most tightly designed game or a balanced game. I think I go into it just for a sense of fun and whimsy. And I think the artwork does a really good job at letting me know that that's what I should expect in this kind of a game. Because from what I remember of my playthroughs, it was never like a balanced or reasonable experience, but I always had a good time. And like the notion of the 3D board that's on there, and what Aaron didn't go into, was the 3D board has basically like a giant Shepherd's Hook sort of mechanism that can sweep the entire actors off the stage if the king's mood shifts, and all your little tokens that you've accumulated that have, you know, made their way onto the stage can just immediately be discarded if the mood of the play is just, no, the king just doesn't want that. And that level of back and forth, sort of the destructive nature in something you've built kind of lets me know that this isn't a game to take too seriously. And that frustration that you're describing, I think, is just one of those things that, as you said earlier, in a longer game would be completely insufferable and unacceptable. But in a game of this level and this time length, I'm kind of more okay with it, as long as everyone at the table understands that that's what we're in for.
What Josh is talking about is something I kind of glossed over with the character abilities. One of the actors, when you select him, gives you an ability where you can send your little chicken actors or chicken managers onto the stage and collect coins based on however many chicken managers are already there. And as the king's favor switches, it can push off all the other managers already there. So it is cool. This game has a really good toy factor.
Game is like one of the cutest games I've ever played.
Yeah.
Hands down, I think it's adorable. Mm. Like, production quality is great. I think it's great. The 3D stage on its own could sit on a board game shelf and just be cute. Like, I would play little figurines with it. Maybe that's just my own little weirdness, but I think it's super cute and fun, and you can, like, act out a little play on the stage and flip it. That is an instant, whether it's a gimmick or not. Jeremy Fleury, who does the artwork for Oceanos as well, which also made me buy that game because I just love his art style. Like, it's so whimsical and so colorful and captivating, and very, very approachable. And I think the game comes across as that.
Not to go too obnoxiously with miniatures corner either, but I really like the miniatures in this game. They're really easy to read. They have distinct silhouettes. They look like the art from far away, and they look like the art from closer up. Now, I know that there was some confusion the first time we played the game, just moving the wrong pieces around. But also at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you put a ship where a rabbit goes or a rooster goes, or you put the rooster where the ship goes.
Well, see, I'm actually going to disagree with you, because you are limited to only three of your roosters and your eight ships. So, and I do think that they get mixed up. So I could see somebody accidentally putting out a fourth, what they think is a rooster, without realizing it.
I feel like in order for that to happen, they would have already had to collect so many times in order to see, like, enough people would be looking at the stage that I think that would get caught. I could see it happening once or twice, but generally speaking, like, while that could be a problem, it's never like a game of Risk where, you know, you bump the board slightly and it all gets jumbled. It's pretty clear what's what.
You guys messed these up?
Who messed people these did up? People what? Continuously did.
What?
Every play of the game they did.
They're because, so distinct looking.
Because you have like 11 of them in front of you, and like people just don't pay attention when they grab something.
Well, people who should be distracted when rules are being explained to them should clearly have been separating their tokens and making a little action scene out of them, and I don't know what they were doing otherwise, but that's what should have been done.
A small concession to Aaron's otherwise ridiculous argument is that if you look at them straight on, they do actually have similar silhouettes, but that's if you're, you know, looking at them exactly right down the middle.
My argument,
they do look kind of similar.
My argument is based in fact of every single time I played this, people have confused it.
I mean, I know I did, but I was also drinking fairly heavily.
And then the other three times, it happened again.
Those people have no business in show business, clearly.
So this game goes up to five players. I've only played it at four players. Every single time I played this game was at four players. I can't imagine how much you probably end up overlapping with that number of players, because so as the cards come out, a round happens, people take their cards, and then any cards that were still out there remain for the next day or the next, I believe they're days in the season. So then there'll be several spots that have more cards than the other. So this game gets into a push your luck kind of mechanism that I enjoy. And I don't love push your luck, but again, because it's a shorter game, I don't mind it.
I would like to try this with three, though. I did feel like four was a little congested. Like Aaron, I can't imagine five. It sounds incredibly frustrating, although some of that will be just dictated by our own experiences. I like the idea of making choices between the cities, not based entirely on the chance of losing everything, but more on what the respective cities are offering and where you've been already. The fact that the consequences for going to the same city are so high and that they're inflicted so arbitrarily is kind of a big deal.
Do you think the game relies on the fact that players are going to visit the same city? Like, would the king's mood change as much if players didn't have that mechanism? Like, I think the game wants the king's mood to be very flip-flop in nature, to be very unpredictable. And so, like, I think the game wants to trap you into going to the same city because that's how the game wants itself to function.
Well, and there is a strategy in this game, mm-hmm. because you can manipulate that. If you know someone's going to a certain spot, you can purposely go there in order to get the king's favor to pass in the direction you mm-hmm. want it to go.
Yeah, I think that's a bigger part than would let on it with that initial frustration. Like, there's some opportunities kind of in that frustration, but I could see it going both ways, really.
I think what strategy is to be had in this game is, can you make some kind of sense out of chaos? Like, that's what the game is. The game is, can you be adaptable? Can you look at the myriad ways that random things can happen? And how can you try to work the chaos to your favor?
Why don't we switch gears a little bit and talk about Shakespeare? The game Shakespeare, not the person, mythical or real, or the genre or the theme.
Yeah, so Shakespeare is a game from 2015. It is for 1 to 4 players. It does have a solo mode. It is designed by Herve Regal with art by Arnaud Demegd and Neriac. It's published by Istari Games. In Shakespeare, we are all the players are a group of rival companies trying to put on the best play at the end of 6 days of preparation and rehearsal time. So the game Shakespeare, it's a Euro-style game, so the game is broken into 6 days. Each day is broken into 6 phases, like everyone's favorite Euro games is broken into rounds and phases and sub-phases. The first phase of each game is wagering, and that's how you determine your player order each time. This game's kind of in my memory, very punishing with that, because basically you wager how many actions you want to take, and the person with the fewest actions gets to go first. So you constantly have to balance how many actions you'd like to take versus how early you'd like to go in initiative order. And then after that is the bulk of the game, is the recruitment phase. So in Shakespeare, you're trying to get a tableau of actors and craftspeople who are basically all have abilities, and you want to use them to kind of manipulate the point salad of the game to do a multitude of things. Actors, when you use them, let you move up on act tracks. There's an act one, an act two, an act three. And how far you move up on those tracks can give you a variety of points throughout the game. And then craftspeople let you buy costumes and set pieces. Costumes get to be put on your actors, and if you can fully clothe your actor, they give you bonuses. And when you build your set, every set piece you put on gets more bonuses for your play, whether money or points. And the set, like all good sets, I guess, has to be built symmetrically and from the bottom up, because you can't build a set at the top and then work your way down. That is the bulk of Shakespeare, is activating your actors and craftspeople. So after everyone's activated all their people, or whatever people they would like to activate, then the table as a whole determines how much ambience everyone's theater has. And there's a variety of little things that can give your theater better ambiance or worse ambiance. And once you've determined how your level of niceness in your theater, you can either get a bonus or a penalty. And your theater mood is reset each round. So if the people seeing the preview today don't really like it, you can change it around tomorrow and maybe pick up a bonus on the next day. After you determine how nice your theater is, the next thing is dress rehearsal. This only happens on days 4 and 6. And dress rehearsal is when any of your actors that are fully clothed, they have to be fully clothed, will activate a special ability, which lets you manipulate one of the act tracks, and everyone will score based upon their positioning on the act tracks. And again, this happens on day 4, kind of as a mid-game, and day 6 as a final scoring. At the end of that, you have a maintenance phase where you clean up all the stuff that's on the table, the cards and the chips that you buy throughout the game. And the last phase is the resting, which is an interesting bit of this game. Whenever you activate an actor or a craftsperson, at the end of the round, they have to rest because they're tired, so you can't use them the next day. An exception is you can make one person do double duty, and you don't have to rest them, but everyone else you've activated must rest for one day, so you kind of have to plan which actors you use which day. At the end of the 6th day, you total up points. There's a few bonus points you can get, but most points are gained during the course of the game, so you kind of know where everyone stands. One thing I didn't mention earlier is when you recruit actors and craftspeople, they all have a cost, but you don't have to pay them until the end of the game. So you can kind of plan how much money you need to finish the game with. And if you don't pay anybody, you lose points. Tiebreaker comes down to money if two people tie for points. And that's Shakespeare. I think I'd say again, this is a game with art I really like. It's not as cutesy as Histrio, but I still like the art. I think all the characters are evocative of the character they're supposed to be from the play. Like, you can look at the picture. Without its name on the card, I could look at the picture and go, that's Othello, and that's Iago, and, like, that's Bianca.
And they're interesting, too. The style feels very restrained, to the point that when I first started playing the game, I didn't realize how new it was. But the closer you look, the more details you'll find, the more composed it, you'll discover that it actually is. And the more little, there's just a lot of character hidden in there that most of the art stands up to close scrutiny in a fun way. I really did enjoy the way that the game looks and feels. I played this game solo mode, and I was prepared to hate it just because of the kind of game that it is and the amount of setup that it was asking me to do and the amount of reading that I was having to do through the rule book, but I didn't. I had a great time playing it. I would probably play it again solo mode. And at the very end of the book, it makes these recommendations for what good scores are. And mine was like less than half of what it recommended as being a quote good unquote score. And it really just made me want to play again. Like, I think It's an extremely satisfying game solo mode, and for anybody out there who doesn't have people to play with, I might recommend you try it.
The rulebook in this one's weird, because the rulebook explains the game very well, but it's so repetitive. It repeats similar phrases and concepts, but like tweaks it for the different types of people. So it's a dry read. And actually, when I played it with Josh and Chris, Chris was afterwards was like, so is that how the rulebook was organized the way you taught it to us? Clarifying that he wasn't trying to read me, but kind of was. But it's just it's a Euro. Like, sometimes Euros aren't the most intuitive in terms of how to explain them.
I think a Euro can be very intuitive. I think this particular Euro isn't necessarily intuitive. And I have a few strong reasons that I want to touch on later about why I think that is. But in my summary of this game, I will say that this is a good game. I don't love it. I think there's a few things lacking in the gameplay that I enjoy. I agree with Matt and Jameson. I think the game looks nice. There's nothing I like actively dislike about the game. But Matt touched on this a little bit ago, and I want to talk a bit about it as well. And that's that it's kind of brutal. There's some really tough choices in here. And unlike other games where I really enjoyed the tough choices, I don't get enough gratification out of making a good choice in this game to make it worth my effort. I don't find this game that fulfilling that I like enjoy the tension in the game for whatever reason. Like, bidding for your actions is a great mechanic. I really like that they threw that in the game. It makes a really fun start to the round. And then the round sort of feels prescribed by then. I don't find this game has a lot of paths for me to go down. I kind of feel like you do the best with what's left to you on the table. You know, whatever actors you have that aren't asleep from the last round are kind of the ones that you're going to use in your troop, and then they're going to be asleep the next round. So there's some decision-making space in there, but the buildup and the things that you're doing don't give me a strong sense of accomplishment when I'm playing this game. And by the time we finally finished and it dragged on a little bit, I was like, all right, I don't know that I did much in this time frame that I feel great about. Like, the scores were very, very close. We all kind of played a similar game, and I feel like if I played it again, the same thing might happen over again.
I think a big part of that, the random chance plays a huge role in this game, way more than I'm used to seeing in other Euros.
Yeah.
The initial card that you get is gigantic and will absolutely change, you know, your strategy for the game, but also your effectiveness relative to other players, period. There's a gigantic difference in the benefit of having like a value 5 actor versus a value 5 craftsperson or a value 1 actor or whatever. Like, it can be detrimental from the very beginning. And then every round you have these tiles and costumes that are being put out. The order in which they come out is extremely, it can be very punishing, because so much of the game is morale mitigation, even though it doesn't really feel like morale should be a central part of it.
Yeah.
You can get a situation where there's like a lot of purple tiles out there and you're going to lose prestige and there's not really anything you can do about it. Or you can go, you know, you can either try to salvage it for everybody for whatever reason. It just doesn't feel like there are the kinds of checks and balances that I would like to see in a game with this much chance. Instead, you have something that has like the dryness of a Euro, the long-term requirement of a Euro, but without any of the stability that lets a lot of Euros work. And I think if I weren't playing this game by myself, I would have had a very frustrating experience.
I'd like to go back to Josh's point. I think, and I don't mind it so much, I think this is a game of inches. The points are very low. When Jameson said, like, the book recommends, like, scores, if you're playing with 3 or 4 people, the recommended score is, like, 22, 23 points. Yep. I think the score track only goes up to, like, 30. And because you're getting your points throughout the whole game, you're only getting the points in increments of, like, 1, maybe 2. So you are doing a lot just to gain a little bit of a tiny inch. And I get that that can be frustrating, and that can be frustrating to some people. For me, what drags me into this game is the theme, which you're never going to hear me say that. I love dragging in the actors, or dragging in the characters from all the Shakespeare plays. I like that there is a subtle connection between, like, if you drag in Ophelia, that she might affect your performance in Act 2 or Act 3, which is when in Hamlet, Ophelia does her stuff. Like, she's not really in the first act, so of course, why would she affect your performance in your Act 1 of your play? And there's a lot of subtle things that kind of line up like that, which just make me chuckle.
I think sometimes it gets a little too specific into characters, though, or is so arcane that there, you know, might be, you might be trying to see a connection where there isn't one. I think it's Beatrice comes with like a free green costume. And not only could I not find that symbol explained anywhere in the book, or like the details of it, like where that green costume comes from, if it comes from the pool or from the store, or it has to be one that's out there. I'm not sure what the significance of Beatrice wearing green is. Like, I don't know if that was a main color for her in the play, and I just completely missed it. Other times it does feel much more grounded, like the timing of the acts related to the characters. Mark Antony has a very different impact on the show than Falstaff. I have one other big criticism, and this is actually building off something Josh said earlier. Josh said he liked the action bidding mechanic. I really don't. I don't like that a central part of this game is incentivizing you to play the game less. I hate that. Any time that the action as a resource is used that way, I get really bothered by it. And it's not like it has to be part of the game. They chose to limit things in this particular way to reduce the number of turns that you're taking as a player.
I think if you played it multiplayer, Jameson, you might have a slightly different take on that critique. I agree completely with the principle of what you're saying, that action shouldn't be a commodity to be used, but it does make a unique tension where you're like, can I do this in fewer moves? If I can, I can go first. And if I go first, I can do this. And that could really mess them up, because I think we're all gunning for that particular set piece. And if I'm the first one to act, I can take it, or I can recruit this person. So there's definitely a significant weight added to the game just in having to make that crucial decision. But I agree with you that it is a weird resource to not have as many actions to play around with.
I found the action bidding actually the most interesting part of the game, because it really made you think critically in terms of if there was something out there that you needed to get first, and then think about whether or not someone else actually would beat you for that. So it kept me paying attention to what other people were doing, mm-hmm. and then really thinking about what the economy of my actions were going to be.
Yeah.
So it I like things that kind of make things a little bit tighter. I like things that make me feel like I am invested in other people's boards, because I would look over and be like, okay, Chris also has the jeweler that can get him the gold pieces, but he's resting, so I'm the one who's gonna be able to get that gold piece, so I think I can do more actions this round, but I really need that one actor up there. So that kind of like calculus is something that kept me engaged in the game.
I don't mind that as a concept. I just don't like the idea of using playtime as your bid. Like, you could have just as easily used prestige, for example, because given that actions essentially will directly result in prestige, you could probably come up with a pretty similar mathematical concept where you're bidding your prestige in order to go first or go for priority. The thing is that by the way, in the single player variant, you are rewarded for taking fewer actions as well.
Okay.
You get a reward. Now that you're not actively competing with other people, there isn't that tension, mm-hmm. but you're still being directly incentivized for playing the game less. That's what bothers me, given that there are plenty of other things that they could use for that.
But part of that, though, is whoever goes first, whoever bids the least amount of actions and goes first, is getting a point. So it's almost like spending an action on getting a point.
And first selection.
Yeah.
Which can be huge.
Yeah. So it's like almost like an unseen extra action right. You're taking.
I know there were a couple rounds in which I overweighted my actions and ended up with an action that I didn't need to use, and I was kicking myself going, I didn't need to put four actions. I really only needed three, and I should have been able to see that better. But after everything got claimed, I didn't have anything else to do, and I was like, oh, I can't take the remaining costumes because I don't have that person to get that. And it was frustrating.
And vice versa, there was rounds where I bid three and everyone else bid five, so now all of a sudden I got the benefit of going first, but
you could have had a fourth action.
So and I like that. I like that it challenges you and makes you like really think about it.
Yeah, that was my strong point for this game, I think. I do see what you're saying, Jameson, that like wagering away your own playtime and investiture in the game is sort of a punishment. But I think it's the one thing I can say that this game added uniquely to it, I suppose.
Things I didn't like about the game, though. So I don't know like what everyone else's perspective on the morale track or whatever it was called.
Oh, my God.
But
punishing. Yeah. So punishing.
But also like, comedy and tragedy seem like they should be like equally like weighted, but
nope.
At least the iconography makes it look like, oh, you want to get closer to comedy, and if you go towards tragedy, you're going to lose points.
Yeah, that I don't think that's the that's the scale. I think it's just, are your people happy or are they super depressed?
So it's morale and it's not genre. Okay.
Yeah. It's not like like Histrio.
Okay.
Yeah. There are only negatives on the one side and only positives.
The only other thing I thought of is that the show we're putting on is a comedy. So if people are going more towards tragedy, it's bad for the show. And that's why you're losing points and everything.
They, punishing is the accurate word for it. And what I dislike about it is sometimes those punishments feel really arbitrary. I'm not sure why the other players taking a set piece impacts my player's happiness. Like,
well, they took like the materials that you need. Someone went and bought like the railings that you need for Juliet's balcony, and you don't get a balcony now.
Yeah, but I don't really want a game about suffering unless that's the central idea.
I hate take that mechanics that are just like a little bit of the game. Like, this game is 98% take that free, but there's 2% take that, because it feels like there's never enough to go around. It feels like there's always one person that takes advantage of the take that, and everyone else just gets punished by it.
But it wasn't even like Chris had the character. Who was it? Did he have Othello? Who did he have? There wasn't an actor who made everyone else sad when he was on stage. And it's not that Chris was like trying to hurt us. But the other benefit of that actor was just using him, so we had to get sad. There wasn't an option not to. And if there's randomly blue things left over on the board, like our end game state for the last game that we played...
It's the purple ones.
The purple ones. Okay, so our end game state in the last one was that we had all like perfectly calculated and then somehow overlooked the fact there was going to be a purple tile left on the board. And we all, our whole happiness scale swung. Like, Chris didn't have the one coin he needed to pay his final actor, which I will talk about that in a minute. It's just the most ridiculous tiebreaker in the world, but that's fine. So the game was just very swingy on what felt like a really arbitrary detail that didn't have anything to do with my play or my production or my theater troupe. It just happened to be that no one needed this set piece that was sitting out here, and now everyone's sad about that.
So do you want to touch on that before we go into comparison?
Okay, so in this game and in this particular round that I played with my partner and Aaron, I will not say that I played a great game in any way, shape, or form. However, the tiebreaker for this game is coins, which sounds fine. But here's the little caveat that the rulebook is sort of clear but not clear about.
We could have played this completely wrong. Like, we didn't even board
game. We could have. I don't know. And maybe someone else has had this exact instance. So at the end of the game, Chris couldn't pay one of his actors. Boo on Chris. Like, again, this happened because of an arbitrary swing of the mood meter. But so his actor was short. So Chris got penalized victory points, which is already punishing enough. However, the way that you pay your actors, I guess, is by assigning coins to the thing. So
we don't know that, though. We don't know if you have to like pay what you have, or you just don't pay them anything.
I assume like good sportsmanship is to at least pay your actor a token of what you can owe him. Therefore, if you can't pay your actor, you should be out of money. And if you've planned well enough to pay all your troop, then they should all be happy with you. However, it doesn't work that way. Chris kept all his money, thus giving him 4 coins and me 3 coins, and he somehow won the game for whatever reason. And that brings about my big criticism of the game, is that the end game didn't feel like it mattered to me. I don't feel a direct connection between the actions I was taking in the game to my end result of the game. And I think it touches on the theme, and I know we're going to talk about that in a little bit, but I don't dislike the game. There was nothing about the game that I like hated. It just didn't give me a big enough payoff, a big enough sense of accomplishment for the like 2 hours that I put into building up this troop. I don't even know how long the gameplay took us, but it felt long, and it felt longer because at the end of the game, I had nothing to show for it. I hadn't assembled this great thing. I don't feel like I'd put on a play. I just had sort of like kind of run an engine, but I didn't really build an engine. I just took arbitrary actions that were the best things available to me at a given moment and ended up with an arbitrary number of points.
So the game actually was fairly short. Like, we were done with that game within maybe like an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay.
But the fact that it felt long was not a good thing for me. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes it just, time should be flying when you're having fun.
Can we talk a little bit also, I will just continue my rant a little bit. The components are also very fiddly in this game, and I'm fine with that as a Euro game, but it took a significant amount of time. The reset between each round takes a while. Like, a good portion of the game is set just resetting the entire board 6 times throughout the game.
Also the setup.
Yeah, it's a little bit tedious.
Yeah, the initial setup when you're playing with less than maximum player count is a little annoying, to have to get the exact right number of costume and set pieces put in the bag.
Well, the annoying thing about it, and maybe we just missed this in the rules, so maybe this is just on us, I didn't see anywhere where it said take out this number of red, this number of blue, this number of black. It just said use this card to know how many to put in. So
yeah, no, it's how many to put in,
yeah,
not how many to take out. Yeah. Now, I guess if you look at the component list, you know how many of each color there are, so you could deduce backwards how many to take out, but it doesn't phrase it that way. It would be nicer if it just said, take out 2 red set pieces,
yeah. Yeah.
Not put in 17 red yep. set pieces.
Yep. So switching over into comparison, I want to start off talking comparison with theme. And I didn't get a ton of putting on a show, like a Shakespearean show, from either of these. And listening to Matt, it made me go back and think about it. And I was like, oh, yeah, I get that. I get that this character brings up the second act, because that's when this character is important. So when you rehearse this character, that's why your second act track goes up. But they both felt very... For Shakespeare, it felt very dry. It felt very Euro, and it felt very mechanical because, I mean, it's like the first act. It's just these tracks, like the hallmark, or what I view as a hallmark of a Euro game, of a big part of it is a race to see who can get the highest up a certain track. And so I appreciated the art, and I appreciated what they were going for, but I never really felt like I was putting on a show. And then in Histrio, I definitely didn't feel like I was putting on a show in that one. I feel like maybe it was a little bit closer, but between, I didn't really get what sending the managers out was doing. Like maybe that's trying to hyping the show, and just the different actors. It never really came together for me for the theme.
I think that both of these games are very much about putting on a show, not putting on a show. They're much more about the actual day-to-day grimness of building the sets and rehearsing than the product that comes out at the end of it, which some of our recommendations are going to be talking much more about the show itself, where this, I mean, I don't think there's any other way to interpret Shakespeare than this is how miserable you are behind the scenes while you're trying to get all this done in a week.
Yeah, I think Jameson has it there. I don't think going in thinking these are games about putting on a show, they're games about kind of theater management. And that's, I think they both do an okay job capturing that. Just one is more serious than the other. But I would say neither of them is a game about actually putting on a show.
Or at least the show part of putting on a show.
Yeah, you're not trying to make a performance at the end. So if you're going in thinking, oh, it's a game about like building up to a performance, no, they're both games about managing, making a troupe and dealing with money and reputation and stuff like that.
And I feel like Histrio did a better job of communicating that. I think one of my favorite things about Histrio is that it gets the sense, like you can play the same game over and over and over again and tell a continuous story. There's a lot of board games out there where there's, you know, the game itself tells the length of the story, and if you play the game again, you're kind of overriding the previous one. You're telling the same story. Here, it just feels like almost like baseball or something, where it's just another season. It's the same characters you had before, and you got to go to these cities again. And I think that the way that the miniatures are used, the way that the people are retained, you know, sending your pack of roosters to go and crow in the court and try to like drum up press for your show, I felt like the actual atmosphere of putting on a show, building the sets, communicating, you know, marketing, talking a little bit of trash. I don't know enough about theater to know how realistic this aspect is, but I felt like the theme was communicated better through Histrio. And Shakespeare really did feel, when I was playing it, like I was meant to be putting together the product at the end, and then there just never was a product.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I agree with you in saying that there wasn't a product at the end. I don't feel like I got anything by the time I assembled this cast, maybe put some clothes on them, maybe had some people back behind the stage. We didn't really do much of anything, it felt like. Histrio, what I think it does a good job thematically of is the reading the crowd and the mood, like the king's favor and the whims of just the theatrical audience being a dictator in how good or how badly you're doing. I like that it brings that into the play. Shakespeare, I wasn't feeling it. I didn't feel anything strongly. Like, I didn't dislike it. It was lacking something for me. And I think it was the fact that the theme felt artificial or pasted on or very mechanical in a way that I don't think Shakespeare should feel in a game.
It just kind of clicked for me that Shakespeare isn't it's not that it's just about the backstage. It's about that it completely ignores the acting part of it, it just entirely. When you're working on the three acts, it's almost like you're writing the acts. Like the quill icon is certainly linked to the character of the writer. You're just working on the script. When you're putting you're paid in this game by putting together costumes and putting together a good looking set. Like none of the rewards in this game are for actually putting on the show itself. The game ends before that actually happens. It's just getting ready to do that. And I think once you think about it in those terms, that this is a game about making beautiful costumes, putting together a great script, and having a great set. That might be a little less glamorous, but at least once it's clear that that's what the game is about, it might become a little more fulfilling.
Yeah, I think a way you could look at it is whoever wins Shakespeare is the person with the best opening night. It doesn't mean you put on a good show. You've just drummed up and done the best getting people to show up for opening
night. So I almost feel like it's less than that. I almost feel like it's whoever wins Shakespeare is the person who is most confident before the curtain goes up for the first time.
Yeah. Well,
that's what I mean. That like feels very true to me. You've gotten the most people to show up at opening night. Like you've advertised that you got these cool costumes, this cool set, you've done some dress rehearsals and they might've gone well. So your opening night is just going to have the most people at it.
You're just the most ready and you have the most eyes on your show.
Right, and it means nothing about how good your show is. You're just you are most ready.
See, I kind of feel the opposite. I kind of feel like how you described how Shakespeare was supposed to be with moving the acts up. That's more so about the quality of that act. So, and that's where a lot of your points come is not so much because I feel like there's not an advertising mechanic in it. It's all about how good are your costumes, how good is your set. And that all kind of comes down to like how good the show is, which kind of then brings it back to my original complaint because like it didn't feel like I get what I think they're going for. And obviously that might not be what they're going for because we all have very wildly different things.
there really weren't that many points coming from the what I'll call the script itself. Like the what seems to be center stage, to coin a phrase, is the three acts there. But like there's other than not wanting to be in last place, the victory points do not really come very much from writing the three acts. They just don't. There are penalties associated with them. Almost like that. Is it Alchemists where you have to like publish things? It's publish or perish.
Yep.
So there's penalties for not working on it, but it doesn't seem like the victory points are there at all, other than a couple of token ones.
I think you're right. I think you touched on something earlier, Jameson, that it feels more to me like we are all our own version of Shakespeare conceptualizing a play. Hmm. And the person who does that best is the play that's actually going to go to stage. Because everyone has their own Shakespeare character on their board. So everyone is, in essence, your own author, sort of thinking up a play with this cast of characters and putting the best thing together that you can. And that, to me, feels the most accurate to how I felt during the game, because I felt like we were all kind of doing the same thing, just with slight variations with a different cast of characters, seeing who could make the best thing out of whatever resources they had floating around in their brain at a certain time. And the acts, I agree, kind of felt arbitrary, but they felt like I was kind of building towards getting a good, solid first, second, and third act, I guess.
I think the way we were having problems coming at Shakespeare, I think can kind of show how these two games take the same thematic idea and go differently. That Shakespeare, by calling it Shakespeare, gives you that feeling that, you know, we're all trying to be the best version of Shakespeare, while Histrio, you know, it is obviously that you're in a Shakespearean world, but it's kind of more broadly just a game about like Elizabethan theater. So one of us could be Shakespeare at the Globe, one of us could be Marlowe. Like, you could be different theater troupes, so it kind of has that feeling that you are different people because the theme has just slightly been expanded beyond just Shakespeare himself.
Mm-hmm. So for recommendations this episode, we kind of boiled it down a little bit and just went with show production, putting on show, theater in general.
We focused less on what these games have in common and more kind of about what I think we thought the games were going to be about, which is putting on a show, you know, the show itself. So all of our recommendations are along those lines.
Mine isn't.
Okay, except for Matt's.
Well, why don't you go first, Matt?
So I went a little bit differently. I took the literary theme and I would like to recommend Marrying Mr. Darcy, which If you love Shakespeare, you should play Shakespeare in Histrio. You'll enjoy them. If you love Jane Austen, if you're an Austenite,
it's delightful.
You need to play Marrying Mr. Darcy. Basically, the whole game is you creating like an RPG character that you're given one of the sisters, one of the Bennet sisters, and you have to get cards to make them more witty, more pretty, give them better quips. So at the end of the game, you can attract the husband that you want from the story. Otherwise, you're going to get a husband you don't want. And it's
Wiggum.
It's just wonderful fun. Yeah, no one wants Mr. Wiggum. No one. I don't even think he's on anyone's first choice list. No one wants him as their first choice.
My recommendation is one I've talked about a couple times now. It is Show Manager from Queen Games. You are putting on different shows in different cities around the world. It is a... You're buying cards. It can be very infuriating because people can pay money to clear the cards. So you never want to look to see what's coming up because it's going to get wiped away and you're going to be really mad at someone. But it's a ton of fun, light on theme, but it's a good time. Show Manager.
My recommendation is also one that we've talked about a number of times on this show, but it is Colosseum, the Days of Wonder edition. It is a direct game about putting on a show, acquiring prop pieces, actors, components, selecting what show you want to put on, and then performing it for an audience for victory points. And I think it does the putting on a show theme better than either of these two games does.
My recommendation is also one that Aaron and Josh have talked about a lot on the show, and that is Tricarion, which is you're a magician. It's set in Victorian times, but you're putting on a trick. You're putting together a trick, and your assistants are running around getting you the materials, preparing the show, and establishing yourself in this little community as you run down what you need to do to put the greatest trick together, the greatest illusion, and kind of demonstrate how much better you are than your compatriots.
And Tricarion has an expansion coming out that had a Kickstarter early this year. Don't know if there's a late pledge option, but if there is, you should go get it because everyone should play Tricarion.
Causes to put this episode together is that we have realized that we all kind of feel strongly about certain themes in games. And there are games that we are more likely to play just because they're set in a location, a time period, or a world that we just particularly want to embody or want to live in. And for some of us, that's the past. Some it's the future. Some it's the fantastical. Some it's hyper-aggressive. But... we want to talk a little bit about the impact that setting, more so than theme, has on our gameplay experience.
I'm pretty known for being a historical setting person. I generally like one of two things. I guess it's probably one of two. Anything ancient Greek or Rome. I love anything set in ancient Greece or Rome. Or anything that deals with between about the Elizabethan, the Georgian, and the Victorian time period in England. Part of that is because I was a British lit major. Particularly, I only studied Victorian literature because when you're a British lit nerd, you kind of narrow it down as small as humanly possible.
Yeah, there's very specific choices there.
Yeah.
So, like 1830s romantics. British.
Ugh.
Thomas Love Peacock. Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry.
That was a huge derail. I'm really sorry.
There was no disgust in my voice. So any game that's even vaguely in like a British provincial countryside, regardless of what the actual theme is, I'm going to look at it and be like, ooh, you know, British countryside. Yeah, I'll play that game. Same with, you know, if something says, ooh, this game set in ancient Rome. Well, I'll be dragged in by that, ignoring possibly mechanics and ignoring possibly what the particular theme is. The setting is generally enough for those two topics to get my foot in the door.
One of the reasons why I play war games, and one of the things that attracts me to board games too, is when settings are demonstrated in a very literal and absorbing way. But for those of you who don't know, when you play a good war game, you're doing it on a table with detailed terrain. And there's attention paid to that terrain. You're moving around the trees, you're not moving through them, or you're moving through the woods and it's slowing you down, that kind of thing. So for me, let's use Star Wars as an example. Just saying that it's Star Wars, setting it in Star Wars isn't enough for me. Like having a picture of Luke on a card and a picture of Vader on a card does nothing for me. When you have a game like Star Wars Rebellion, where the board itself is set up to look like the kind of display that the characters are looking at, and you're moving things around this map of the galaxy, and you're thinking about the topography of the planets, even though there's no actual mechanic reflected there, but you're looking at the colors of the worlds, and you're looking at the, sort of the space between them and the blackness of night beyond that. That's what pulls me in there. It's a very visual thing when setting matters. And I think that something that I can actually dislike is when games acknowledge a setting without doing anything about it. When they just have a brand and they just put that image somewhere on the cards without actually, or whatever, without actually linking the physicality of the game to the setting, to the place.
I agree with you, Jameson. One of the things, I mean, Matt and I agree very similarly on a lot of our themes. I tend to have themes that I sort of am more cautious of. There are themes that I'm like, yep, there are settings that I'm less hesitant to jump right into. If it's something about the Italian Renaissance period for whatever reason, any ancient theme pretty much gets me going. And I love a clever steampunk Victorian. When we start going futuristic, for some reason, I get more critical. I don't know why, but it doesn't resonate with me as much. I start being like, I don't necessarily need that game, or I'm not as impulsive to just purchase and dive into it. I will always play anything. But there are some themes that I just generally sort of like get my back up. Cthulhu and the Arkham world in general, I'm just done with it. None of the games really get a Cthulhu theme for me. Horror in general is not my favorite genre to play in, with the exception of around Halloween time. But I don't know. I think setting, for whatever reason, really impacts my gameplay choices. Like I feel like when I play a game, looking at the artwork and living in that world takes me to a different place. And I love more than anything else when the mechanics and the gameplay match the setting. But even if they aren't quite on par with one another, I'm always really interested just to see what a designer does and why they've chosen that setting or that theme to overlay on top of a game.
So for me, and I know I've talked about this a lot in the past, fantasy, sci-fi, space, other worlds, magic.
Superheroes.
Those are all the things that appeal to me in terms of settings. When it comes to history, when it comes to the past, I really do disengage. And I don't talk about... I have a bunch of different reasons for this. And like the reason that I kind of want to talk about today is that I have a very hard time romanticizing the past. Like when I think about the past, I think about slavery. I think about homophobia. I think about xenophobia. I think about like all the horrible things that were just so commonplace. Like,
and just the day to day, like nobody brushing their teeth.
Like I'm not even just that, but just like the idea of like societies that were cool with owning people.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know. It ruins the illusion for me. Like, I don't think of it as like good old days. I think of it as I'm so happy that I live when I live.
Yeah.
That's a big can of worms right there.
I honestly agree with you, Aaron. And for me, like one of the things that I tend not to like about Euros, sorry, entire category of games, is that they do tend to have this almost like softened edges, rose-colored glasses look toward a lot of the stuff. Great Western Trail is an example of this, where it just takes all of the edges off. It just has this almost, this really gentle kind of cartoony look at what was an incredibly devastating and exploitative part of world history, and honestly was made more interesting by just how awful it was and how big the dreams were and how big the falls were. It's about more than just like, you know, paying off these people who are in your way and moving cattle around. And I feel like there's a real tendency in board games, because they're a little bit less literal and they're necessarily more abstract. Maybe it's because they're marketed a lot of times towards families. Maybe it's just because there's a sort of a tone that tends to go there. It's that board games, kind of grounded in history, tend to be soft in my mind a lot of the time. And I don't mean that they're not edgy enough. I mean that they present something almost like Downton Abbey, where they just take something that had a lot of complexity to it and instead just like have a little, you know, kind of just a pleasant little romp with occasional bits of drama in it.
I agree with Jameson that a lot of the time historical games water the edges. We kind of got really into that when we did Mombasa with Great Western Trail. I more am going to not counter Aaron's point. I guess just from my own perspective, I don't romanticize these periods. Like, what interests me so much in the Victorian period is all that stuff. What I get interested in is all the horrible things that were going on at the time, and not that it's not like a I fetishize the horribleness, but it intrigues me how people did these horrible things, what the justifications were, so you can analyze it and look at it. And personally, like, I'm so fascinated by the Victorians because they're so contradictory, that everything that went on in that period was trying to be moralistic and prudish, but being so debaucherous and so amoral in all their behavior, that's what intrigues me about the period. So when something's set during that period, it's more just evocative of my feelings towards the period, like into my interest level in the period. There's no, for me, there's no romanticizing of like, I don't want to live during the Victorian period, but I like learning about the Victorian period.
And I guess just for me, like, it's when I'm playing a game, I'm just jumping into it. Like, I'm that person in that world doing something. I love theme for that reason, because it kind of is like, there's a level of role playing. There's a level of like being there. And like, I don't know, like it's just so far outside of my experience that, and my mind just naturally gravitates to these things. Like even Shakespeare, the game mentions the fact that they use women characters versus the fact that historically women weren't allowed to act.
Yeah, I did notice that in the rulebook, that they were like, oh, we took like an anachronistic liberty with it. And I was like, I don't really know why you need to take that anachronistic liberty, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can split hairs a lot over this. I don't feel the same way you do, Aaron, about this, because I feel like I love the past and I love learning from the past despite its faults. And I think we have just as many faults in the present right now, and people in the future who look at our present are going to see this exact same thing.
I think all of this, like all of this, shapes our concept of setting in board games. Like, this is, these ideas is why we're drawn to the settings in board games that we are, and everyone else playing board games has these feelings. Like, this is not, I don't think we are off topic in any way. Like, I think we're actually thoroughly on topic of, this is how you approach settings in board games. Like, we all bring this baggage, and that's why we end up getting drawn to the stuff that we do.
So I really like the ancient Rome setting too. And part of that is because of that sort of duplicity. It's presented, and it even presented itself to its citizens as being this like glossy, progressive icon of light in a world of darkness, like an emerging civilization of order and, you know, righteousness. And that's how it was marketed to the plebs a lot of the time. And then you go beneath it, and everything is corrupt from the bottom to the top. People are bought and sold. Cultures are, there's existential violence against groups of people and against groups of ethnicities. There is so much color and so much depth and so much subtext to everything. So when you have a game about gladiators, even though if you're just, maybe you're just moving around figures of gladiators and having your player choices just influence the moves that they're doing. You don't need to get into the idea that like one of Caesar's ways of getting the populace was to like sponsor 20 pairs of gladiators wearing silvered armor as part of his just like marketing. You don't have to get into the fact that like life expectancy was actually higher than many people think it was, but you still tended not to last more than 10 games. Like, even though it wasn't to the death, most of the time you would still tend to bleed out a lot. And you might have a situation where like obese gladiators, people who are still really muscular but who had a lot of flesh on them, the crowd liked to see those people because they would get cut up more and have more blood coming from it. And so the execution of that in a board game can just be, here is an obese gladiator wearing silver armor. And to anybody who doesn't know anything about ancient Rome, it's just a cool guy having a fight on the sand. He's kind of porky, looks kind of cute. Maybe he has a scary helmet, and his armor is cool and silver. And the deeper you go, and I think this is something that Shakespeare at least does pretty well, the deeper you go, the more you realize that there's some thought in every one of those items that's represented there that isn't just paving over the darkness and intricacy underneath.
I would like to take Jameson's point of this intricacy, and I totally agree. I think because games are set in the past, I think everyone, mostly everyone, has some historical period that they're just fascinated with, that you just dig into it as much as you can. But I would like to turn that to the kind of sci-fi futuristic settings, and can we pinpoint specific sci-fi settings that attract us, and why specific sci-fi settings attract us over others?
So this was what I really wanted to talk about next. I'm so glad you mentioned it. It ties into something that Josh said. I love sci-fi generally, but I'm extremely critical of it, especially in board games, because it tends to be so facile. So when I see something that's like another generic sci-fi setting, maybe there's Earth in it, maybe there isn't, but like all of the warships are named after World War One classes of vehicles that, you know, or they... Everything is just represented in this extremely generic way, I get critical. When there are essentially land-based weapons that are just dropped onto these things that are shooting at each other point blank, and the reason for the war isn't clear, the reason for the conflict isn't clear, all of the aliens are just, you know, different shades of human with some additional features sculpted on, like, unless it's specifically Star Trek, that's when my hackles rise. So I've never played a sci-fi game that's like specifically about Ian Banks's culture books, but I would love something that mm-hmm. covered new ground like that. And one of my criticisms of a game like Star Realms, even though I really like it, is that it's so generic as to be essentially meaningless.
I personally have no interest in Mars. I was never a kid that like looked up at the stars and was like, I want to go travel the stars. Like that wasn't me. So games, and I bring up Mars just because there's so many games about Mars recently, but any kind of like terrestrial, like going to another planet or inhabiting another planet, like none of that really interests me as a setting. I don't care. But if you give me like a futuristic planet like Coruscant mm-hmm. with like a giant tech city and things like that, I love that kind of futuristic
setting. Yeah, making a new, unique, because, distinct, interesting place.
Right, because when... For me, I look at, and this comes from my interest in history, I like how technology and things like that change. So I much more prefer sci-fi futuristic settings that look like they could be Earth and our society, but moved forward in time. I don't really, like, it doesn't grab me to be like, oh, here's a sci-fi setting on some planet that I have no context for.
Yeah, I think you're right, Matt. I think when there's a story behind it, I gravitate much more strongly towards it. And I think that's why, like, I latched on to Scythe really hard, because it has a really unique take on an alternative future with a well-realized story that has consequences. Like, you piss off the villagers and lose popularity points when you do an action like that. And I think it's really clever, and it has this unique art style that feels very historically evocative, but captivates you into an alternative future. And that's fun for me to imagine and sort of play around with a little bit. I think you're right, Jameson. The generic settings are difficult to latch onto. And I feel the same way about fantasy settings. Like, a generic Dungeon & Dragon game, maybe with the exception of Clank, even though Clank is super generic, but those games also make it really hard to latch onto, because it's either been overdone or they rely too heavily on tropes that people already know instead of coming up with something unique to give to the game. And I think that's what makes me feel like I'm part of a different universe.
The best ones are ones that acknowledge tropes but are still evocative beyond them. So rather than just saying, this is a battlecruiser, here's a drawing of a battlecruiser, it does 6 damage. You have something that is colored in a way or sculpted in a way or just represents an idea that we've all kind of thought about or could easily get our heads around, but that isn't something that's been expressed to death. So one of the reasons why I love Clank so much, the dungeon crawl is a very old idea, but it is still giving you a new way to do it. You're not just moving along a grid like you would be in the 80s. You are managing your noise. You know what I mean? You're taking these concepts, yeah, which are already central to how you imagine the setting, and expressing them in new ways.
And I think for me, the number one thing that I'm looking for in a theme is just something that gives me enough for my brain just to latch onto mm-hmm. and just go on an adventure. I just want to go escape the day to day and go on.
Absolutely.
And if the world's well developed, great. And if there's just enough just to keep me interested, that's fine too.
It is a really role playing exercise for me a lot of the time. And that might, I mean, it might be weird. Some games not Splendor so much, you know what I mean? But a lot of the time when I look for setting, I look for an opportunity to explore a place.
I think setting is what makes the end game story make sense. Mm-hmm. That when at that moment at the end of a game when you come and you're like, this is what I've done, a good game, I should say. This is what I've done, this is what I've accomplished, and here's how it fits into the like setting this game presented, whether it was me farming untilled fields and turning them into this fertile landscape, or tending a flower garden, or like, you know, killing mutants in a futuristic superhero setting, whatever that is, the setting helps me become entranced in the game and makes the game worthwhile for me and relatable. And that's what I like about a good setting.
And contrastingly, what I dislike about a lot of games, even games that I love, is the sprint that comes in the final quarter or final fifth of a game where you're just trying to finish off your sets and the theme goes by the wayside and you're just trying to, you know, efficiently gather as many points as you can. So when a game like Clank comes along that the sprint at the end is directly related to the setting, it just makes me love it all the more.
This has nothing to do with what any of you were saying, but in terms of setting application and something I meant to mention way earlier about Shakespeare that drives me insane, because there are so many nice details in the game to be evocative of all the characters. There are three act tracks. Shakespeare is the inventor of the five act play. Every Shakespeare play has five acts. His whole shtick is having five acts. He looked at three acts and said, that's stupid. You shouldn't have three acts. And yet it uses the three act. Now, I get having five acts would have been really complicated.
Maybe
but
if people had more actions, they could have.
It's out. Right. You're right, though, Matt. Good point.
I actually think we need to wrap this up because this recording went very long. Join us in 2 weeks, where our category is going to be social deduction. We're going to talk about Crossfire and One Night Ultimate Werewolf. Our music was donated by the band Delicious Pastries. If you'd like to email us, you can reach us at menonboardpodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Men on Board Podcast. Find us on Twitter at Men on Board Pod. We have a guild over on Board Game Geek. Our website is menonboardpodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and good night.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Bye.
Someone want to throw out transition?
No, not at all.
Oh, that might be the end.
Well, Shakespeare's plays were set.
No, it doesn't have to be a dad joke. It can just be a sentence.
Oh, I don't know. God.